What are some examples of anarchist or radical solidarity projects that cross borders, connecting migrants and activists in different European countries? Also, are there examples of solidarity efforts connecting people in the countries from which many migrants are leaving to the countries to which they're arriving?
There are some projects that are like trying to work on that. Like in Geneva, there is a movement at the moment which is called Stop Bunker, which is been created by migrants who were seeking for asylum, and they were living in underground bunkers, and they didn't want to live them anymore, and they started to protest and also started to do political work on it, and they've been supported by local radical and anarchist groups, more on the sense of logistic and legal aid, but they were really leading the struggle, and it was really clear that it was them that led the struggle. But I don't really know that many of examples that are like that. And also very often the experience is that it's really, really hard to do as well. Hard in different senses, like trying not to instrumentalize migrants for your own political ideas, I think is a big issue. Or also, how do you deal with when, for example, migrants decided to make liaisons or connections with organizations like parties, which yourself you would never do? Like, how do you react to that? How much do you tell them what to do or not to do? But at the same time, I think there are lots of projects that have came up which maybe don't have such close connections with migrants themselves, but are still in relation to their struggle. Like, for example, Watch the Mat, which is a group or an organization which has started a year ago, something which is called an alarm phone. So they're doing a hotline for boat people in distress. So it's not, and they're also trying to help the people when they call that are in the sea and maybe something is wrong with their dinghy or boat. They're trying to help them to make sure that the coast guards are really come to rescue them, because it's a big issue that very often the coast guards don't react quick enough, and many people die totally unnecessary death because their reaction wasn't quick enough. So trying to put some of their pressure they have as Western European to support the refugees in that sense. And obviously in the whole Balkan area, there are lots of no border groups. There have been countless kitchens cooking food for migrants on their way to Europe. So lots of support has been going on, but unfortunately not much support which are really close connection to migrants. But I also think this is something which will be worked on when those people now are arriving in Europe, because the people that are at the moment doing their journey and fleeing their country of origin are not, I think, mostly in a state to have any energy or priority to political fights.
What are some of the largest obstacles you face in your struggles to show solidarity with migrants? What advice would you offer to non-migrants who want to act in solidarity with migrants in Europe or even here in the USA or Canada?
One of the largest obstacles in my mind, or something I've put a lot of thought in it before I went to the Balkan, I felt I had a lot of clear anarchist political ideas in my head about how things should be and what's right and how I want it and how I see the situation. But I think everything changes really radically when you have a dying baby in your arm, and you're like thinking, or I've been thinking really much about the situation of like just helping people and not thinking that much about political things in that moment. And sometimes it was also haunting me, because difficult situations are when you are at the camp like that, you get a bit like part of a machinery also of the asylum system, because it was really clear that most people who were there wanted to get the people on the bus to a registration place. Nobody asked the migrant what they want or what their decision is. It's really clear that the border is there. You're like supporting the border in a way that people are being sent to the next border where they're taking over. You're standing in front of the border. You're not destroying it. You're not destructing it. You're just helping people that they have enough food or water and get medical care. So lots of thinking about this differentiation between like your ideas and the reality, which also I think led to really fruitful discussion in generally. And then also positive things, this impression or idea that thousands of people are doing support to migrants that are not linked to any government or any NGO, but just doing self-organized work and helping people fleeing over the border. And this has been done also in a very direct way, like people just taking the car and driving people to or over the border, just making sure like that an app existed where people could go through and what are the best way to reach their goal. So for me, those are also very strong actions and sometimes also very direct actions. And a lot of people have been doing things like that that would normally not classify themselves in an anarchist or radical way. And I totally would what they have done. So this is also, I think, a chance for people really experience how self-organization can work and does work.
Can you describe an anarchist or radical strategy for how we might respond to the border or migration crisis and a vision of a free world beyond the system of national borders?
This, I think, is the hardest question. And no, I don't know the strategy of how we might respond and react to this crisis. I think for me, one of the main things have been about doing something and supporting, which I felt was actually supporting, but still giving people as much possibility to take their own decision or also help them in taking their own decision and having a possibility to do what they think is right for them. And yes, I think I have a really clear vision, like you already said, a vision of a world beyond the system of national borders, but how to get there, I have absolutely no idea. Maybe that sounds a bit frustrating, but I hope on the way of doing active things and really like just trying out things, we will find a way.
As we finished work on this episode, the Islamic State struck in a coordinated attack in Paris that left at least 129 people dead and hundreds more wounded. In Europe, rumors that one of the attackers entered France as a refugee or had a Syrian passport fueled the escalated anti-immigration and anti-Islamic sentiment, giving politicians the impetus for further tightening of border controls. Here in the U.S., more than a dozen states across the country halted plans to accept Syrian refugees, mosques received death threats, and politicians stepped up anti-immigrant rhetoric. The Democratic mayor of Roanoke, Virginia, actually compared the situation with ISIS in Syria to World War II and cited, seemingly approvingly, the U.S. government's internment of Japanese Americans in concentration camps as a justification for suspending all efforts to offer support to Syrian refugees.
Of course, all of this plays directly into the hands of the Islamic State, who aim to increase the polarization between Arab and Islamic people and folks in the West with whom they might otherwise find common cause against militarism, patriarchy, and exploitation. In this moment of increasing polarization between different oppressive authoritarian power blocks, it's more important than ever that anarchists articulate visions for worlds beyond the binary of fundamentalist terrorism or the neoliberal security state. In response to the attacks in Paris, our only hope is to establish common cause across the boundaries of citizenship and religion, before the whole world is carved up on the butcher's block of war. In that spirit, we'll conclude this episode's exploration of borders and migration today with a piece that recently appeared on the CrimeThink blog titled, "The Borders Won't Protect You, But They Might Get You Killed."
In Paris, on November 13th, 129 people were killed in coordinated bombings and shootings for which the Islamic State claimed responsibility. Although this is only the latest in a series of such attacks, it has drawn a different sort of attention than the massacres in Sirte and Ankara that together killed at least 135 people. The lives of young activists who support the Kurdish struggle against ISIS, so far the only on-the-ground effort that has blocked the expansion of the Islamic State, are weighted differently than the lives of Western Europeans. The same goes for the lives of millions who have been killed or forced to flee their homes in Syria. European nationalists lost no time seeking to tie the attacks in Paris to the so-called migrant crisis. British headlines proclaimed, "Jihadis sneaked into Europe as fake Syrian refugees," alleging that a passport found with one of the assailants belonged to a refugee who passed through Greece. These opportunists hope to use the blood still wet on the streets to anoint their project of locking down Fortress Europe. Ironically, many of the people attempting to enter Europe from the Middle East are fleeing similar attacks orchestrated by ISIS. This is why they have been willing to risk death, crossing border after border to reach an unwelcoming Europe. Cutting off their escape route would trap them in territory controlled by ISIS, arguably increasing the resources of the Islamic State and indisputably exacerbating the frustrations that drive people to cast their lot with Islamic fundamentalism. Surely this was clear to the people who planned the attacks. It may have even been among their objectives.
There is a chilling symmetry between the agendas of the nationalists of Europe and the fundamentalists of the Islamic State. The nationalists wish to see the world divided into gated communities in which citizenship serves as a sort of caste system. European history shows that in a world thus divided, the ultimate solution to every problem is war. The fundamentalists, for their part, hope to assert Islamic identity as the basis of a global jihad. In this regard, the only real difference between ISIS and the European nationalists is over whether the criteria for inclusion in the New World Order should be citizenship or religion. Both ISIS and the nationalists want to see the conflicts of the 21st century play out between clearly defined peoples governed by rival powers, not between the rulers and the ruled as a whole. Both want to force the refugees to take a side in the war between Western governments and the Islamic State, rather than participating in the sort of grassroots social change once promised by the Arab Spring. Of course, the tightening of Fortress Europe and the next wave of airstrikes would be promoted as a way to keep Europeans safe from foreign barbarians, not as a means of escalating global conflict. But can borders protect against attacks like the ones in Paris? Has the war on terror made the world a safer place?
Let's go back to September 11th, 2001, when Al-Qaeda carried out attacks in Manhattan and Washington, D.C. In response, then-President George W. Bush committed the United States to military invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, intended to make the world safe for democracy, rhetoric taken from another president who sought to justify a war to end all wars while demonizing immigrants. One of Bush's justifications was that by occupying these rogue states, the U.S. military could disable the staging areas from which acts of terrorism were coordinated. The Bush administration was proposing to protect U.S. citizens by means of the same indiscriminate violence that had produced so much resentment against them in the first place.
Anarchists didn't buy it. In response to the September 11th attacks and the military operations that followed, we blanketed walls across the United States with posters proclaiming, "Your leaders can't protect you, but they can get you killed." As we predicted, the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan only destabilized the Middle East, fostering new generations of embittered Islamic fighters. Just as Al-Qaeda was originally funded and trained by the CIA, Today, ISIS is armed with the very military equipment sent to Iraq to impose U.S. control on the region. As we wrote in 2006 in Rolling Thunder No. 3, the Bush administration could hardly have been more effective at generating Islamic resistance if that had been its explicit goal.
Mere world domination is no use to a repressive regime. As soon as there are no barbarians at the gates to point to as the greater of two evils, the subjects start getting restless. Witness the decade following the fall of the Berlin Wall, when the internal resistance grew and grew in the vacuum left by the communist menace. War without end may make people restless too, but it also keeps them busy reacting to it, if not dying in it, instead of cutting to the root of the matter. Militant Islam, once a backyard startup company, is finally a global threat, poised to replace the communist bloc. Western-style capitalism has extended its influence and control so far that external opposition must now come from previously peripheral corners of the world, such as Afghanistan. A few fanatics from that periphery were enough to inaugurate the new era of terror versus democracy back in 2001, but it will take a lot more fanatics to maintain it, and the current U.S. foreign policy will produce them.
Intensifying security and border controls will only exacerbate the tensions that propel people into the ranks of ISIS from France and Britain, as well as in Iraq and Syria. Clamping down the borders around Europe means clamping down on every aspect of life inside them. Special forces have been deployed to back British police. The New York City Police Commissioner hopes to increase surveillance of communications devices. Former French President Sarkozy wants to force everyone suspected of radicalism to wear an electronic tag. This is not just a question of how refugees are treated, but of what life will be like for all of us in an era of ever-increasing state control.
The attacks in Paris are convenient for those who have been struggling to subdue social unrest. When Hillary Clinton says, "We are not at war with Islam, we are at war with violent extremism," the implication is that everyone who stands up for himself against the clampdown will be treated as a violent extremist. In the United States, the National Guard have been deployed 3 times over the last 2 years to suppress protests against police murders. It's not just ISIS killing people. In Europe, where there have been such powerful protests against austerity, 68 anarchists have been arrested on terrorism charges over the past 3 years, in retaliation for social movement activity, not attacks on civilians. From Washington, D.C. and Paris to Raqqa and Mosul, those who hold power have no real solutions for the economic, ecological, and social crises of our time. They are more focused on suppressing the social movements that threaten them. But wherever such movements are crushed, discontent will be channeled into organizations like ISIS that seek to solve their problems through sectarian war rather than collective revolutionary change.
So the clampdown can only make things worse. Tighter border controls won't protect us from attacks like the ones in Paris, though they will go on causing migrant deaths. Airstrikes won't stop suicide bombers, but they will produce new generations that nurse a grudge against the West. Government surveillance won't catch every bomb plot, but it will target the social movements that offer an alternative to nationalism and war. If the proponents of Fortress Europe succeed in suppressing and segregating us, we will surely end up fighting each other, divide and rule. Our only hope is to establish common cause against our rulers, building bridges across the boundaries of citizenship and religion before the whole world is carved up on the butcher's block of war.
In this context, we can draw inspiration from everyone who has defied the borders over the past few months, demonstrating that these artificial divisions can be overcome. In August, hundreds of people broke across the border from Greece into Macedonia. In September, when trains supposedly bearing migrants through Hungary to the Austrian border arrived instead at an internment camp surrounded by fences and riot police, the migrants locked themselves inside the train, refused food and water, and ultimately broke through the fence, escaping across the fields to the highway. In October, over 100 people stormed the Eurotunnel between France and the UK. Just a few weeks ago, thousands of people repeatedly broke through the police cordon separating Slovenia and Austria. In each of these cases, we see people working together to find the vulnerabilities in the walls that partition up humanity. If it weren't for their efforts, We can be sure that European governments would have done even less to support refugees. By breaking open the borders and supporting others who break through them, we can show those fleeing Syria and Mexico and all the other war zones of the world that they have comrades on the other side of the fences. This is our best hope to discourage them from giving up on the possibility of joint solidarity and joining groups like ISIS. Likewise, the more we disrupt the security apparatus and the war machine, the less ISIS will be able to appeal to potential converts by pointing to the harm Western governments are inflicting on Muslims around the world. Every time we do this, we seize the initiative to define the essential struggle of our age. Not terrorists versus governments, not Islam versus the West, but all humanity against the structures and ideologies that pit us against each other.
All right, let's wrap things up with next week's news. Alanis, what's coming up?
Well, we reported in our last episode about the upcoming COP21 protests in Paris, a massive mobilization against the corporate and government-based climate change lobbies that are looking to the climate crisis as an opportunity to reap profits in advanced policing, surveillance, and militarization. But now that the Islamic State attacks have given the French state the impetus to do whatever it wants under the guise of security, police have informed protest organizers that the November 29th climate march is canceled, as well as the December 12th mobilizations against the COP21 gathering.
Oh shit! So that's the era we live in now? Legal protest is canceled?
The organizers tried to put a defiant spin on it, but stopped short of calling for people to protest anyway, regardless of what the government says. What's actually going to happen? We're extremely curious to see. This could provide a test case for how far states can go in using the unlimited securitization supposedly justified by the threat of terrorism to clamp down on all forms of resistance. If you're planning to be at the COP21 protests, we'd love to hear a report back about how things go and what resistance looks like in the face of such an intense climate of fear and repression.
Next, we have an announcement to share about a new prison-focused publication called Unstoppable. Here's what the folks involved had to say about it.
Unstoppable is specifically by and for incarcerated folks who identify as women, gender variant, and or trans. This anti-authoritarian publication seeks to blend radical politics and analyses with personal experiences and observations. We want to elevate the voices on the inside that are often excluded from political dialogues, while also asking people on the outside to convey their social and political realities to people on the inside. Unstoppable aims to build bridges across prison walls and beyond them by facilitating dialogue and engagement between those who are incarcerated and those who are not. Unstoppable is asking for contributions in the form of artwork, poetry, writings, social commentaries, field notes from the prison yard or the streets, critical views of power structures, and more. Unstoppable is particularly interested in focusing on gendered issues and systems of social control in the U.S. context, but we invite a wide array of topics. Such topics might include organizing against police terror, personal triumphs in overcoming past or ongoing trauma, community-based responses to gendered violence and abuse, self-care in high-stress environments, the consequences of deprivation in the U.S. prison system, environmental liberation, forms of resistance in women's prisons, do-it-yourself ethics, etc. Please email unstoppablepublication@gmail.com if you wish to be involved with this project in any way, or if you have a contribution to share.
The inaugural issue should be released in the next month. Stay posted to unstoppable.noblogs.org to read it when it arrives.
In other news, there is a punk and anarchist film festival taking place in Sao Paulo, Brazil on December 5th and 6th. Also, the East Bay Anarchist Book Fair and Conversation event takes place in Oakland, California on December 5th.
We reported last episode on the upcoming sentencing hearing for animal liberation activist Tyler Lang. His hearing has been rescheduled for December 18th. So, if you're in the Chicago area and can make it to the hearing, please come out to show your support. You can get details and updates at supportkevinandtyler.com.
Imprisoned anarchists from the informal organization Conspiracy of Souls of Fire have recently broadcast a call-out for a Black December, an amplification of coordinated global anarchist action in solidarity with comrades who have died and those who are being held behind bars or living in clandestinity. The call reads, from counter-information activities to actions of propaganda by the deed, let's make the most of this month and encounter each other, conspire, and synchronize our strengths in an informal, international, and insurrectionary manner against the world of power. Let's seize the chance to highlight the points we have in common, but also our different perspectives, in a spirit of comradeship and mutual respect. We've got the link to the full call on our website.
Now, here's a weird one. Our old pals at Adbusters magazine, who can't seem to figure out if they're anarchists or liberals or activists or art critics or what, have come up with another zany scheme. Remember when they called for Occupy Wall Street under the idea that everyone would come together and come up with one big demand?
Yeah, and in fact that was impossible, but that impossibility led to Occupy actually spreading and becoming something vital for a second.
Exactly. Well, they seem to have failed to absorb that lesson, and so now they're calling for something called the Billion People March on December 19th, in which they will try to revive the idea that the way to fix everything is to start with a single demand.
Oh, goody.
But this time, rather than all this pesky business of consensus and direct democracy and assemblies, they've helpfully come up with a single demand for us. And it is...
Yes?
Wait for it. It's... A 1% tax on all stock market transactions and currency trades to be paid to the United Nations, I think. It's not entirely clear.
Huh. That's the one demand that's supposed to catalyze a billion people around the world to all do something on the same day?
Yeah.
Well, considering that Adbusters once again pulled a piece of Crime Think writing out of context and pasted it into their latest issue, in which they advanced this latest brilliant morsel of strategic thinking... I kind of wish they had read the Why We Don't Make Demands feature from the spring. That might give them some context for why this admittedly ambitious undertaking is in fact not going to result in an end to climate change, corporate capitalism, existential alienation, or any of the other conditions of postmodern life that Adbusters so evocatively critiques.
Well, that said, we'll wrap things up with prisoner birthdays. On December 12th, Zolo Azania, a Black Panther convicted of a 1981 bank robbery that left a Gary, Indiana police officer dead.
On the 15th, Fred Muhammad Burton, one of the Philly Five, framed for the murder of a cop in 1970.
And two folks on the 17th, Chelsea Manning, U.S. soldier and WikiLeaks heroine who exposed shady military doings in Iraq, and Connor Stevens from the Cleveland Four, a young anarchist entrapped in an FBI-generated bomb plot.
And that's it for this episode of The Ex-Worker. Many, many thanks to Harsha, Vijay, Hannah, Alexandra, and everyone else whose voices, words, and ideas appeared in this episode. As always, you can find plenty of links with more info at our website, crimethink.com/podcast.
And we're eager to hear what you thought about this episode and your ideas for the future by email to podcast@crimethink.com.
We've got lots of exciting stuff coming up in future episodes, including more discussions of borders and migration and our 2015 year in review, so stay tuned.
So, until next time, say it with me here, folks.
Welkom in Sterrenplaten. Vandaag gaan we vrijkaarten weggeven voor Racta en Maarten komt ook langs met de nieuwe Gonzo. Maar we gaan beginnen met een quintet. Het zal zeker niet het laatste zijn vandaag. Je kan er zelfs een drankspelletje van maken. Dit is een Frans quintet. Ze zingen wel in het Engels. Ze komen uit Parijs en hun album heet Juillet. Komt uit op Trouble in Mind. Volgende week is het uit. We draaien Words van En Attendant Anna. Goedenavond. Records van En Attendant Anna van op het album Juillet. Komt volgende week uit. Dat is dus nog januari. We hebben er ook eentje die vorig jaar is uitgekomen. A Light Sleeper, dat is prog uit Chicago met onder andere ook saxofoon en viool. Je hoort het al een heel klein beetje. We draaien daaruit de titeltrack Distinction.
Thank you.
Reaper van op het gelijknamige album. Komt uit op A Ballad in Six Parts. Nog iets van vorig jaar, ontdekt eigenlijk in het eindejaarslijstje van Icarus Records. Mark Trecca, dat is ambient met wervelende piano's, tape loops ook. Komt uit op Blue Sanct, Everything Falling Crosses Over, zo heet het album. We draaien daaruit First Kicking Form van Mark Trecca.